Hello?
Hi, is this Lynn?
Yes.
Hi, Lynn. This is Clarence Moy with Awards Daily. How are you?
I'm good. How are you, Clarence?
I'm good, thank you. Is now still a good time to talk about Little Fires Everywhere?
I have so much going on. I don't really know if I can spare the 20 minutes to talk to you, but I will just put everything aside on my busy calendar. I'm sorry. Yes, it's fine.
Okay, excellent. Yeah, I think we're both in the same boat. Okay, so how did you initially become involved with Little Fires?
Well, I met Reese Witherspoon and her producing partner, Lauren Neustadter, when I was one of the guest episodic directors on The Morning Show. Mm-hmm. So that was the first time I met them, and I was prepping in late November, early December, and then my episode straddled the winter hiatus. So we were shooting at sort of mid-December up until the winter hiatus went away for, you know, a couple weeks, and then came back and I finished in January. And right before the break, Lauren handed me the novel and said, you know, Reese has had a nice time working with you on The Morning Show.
Which is good to hear.
Yeah, it's always good to hear. And we were thinking it might be good for you to read. You know, I was thinking it might be good for you to read this and tell. And if you felt any connection to it, you know, and were interested, we're turning it into a television series. And we would like for you to throw your hat in the ring, you know, and pitch to maybe direct it. So, or be the EP, you know, mm-hmm. director of half the episodes. So I did read it. I read half of it and then I listened the rest on audio tape when I was, because I was on these long car rides and I can't read in the car. And I was just completely amazed by how personally connected I felt to the story on so many different levels. I mean, I felt a bizarre personal connection to a number of the different characters in the book. So aside from just loving the fact that it was this very strong, you know, it was a big ensemble cast of multiple very strong, flawed, interesting, human, you know, layered women, mm-hmm. which you don't see every day. But it was also specifically about motherhood and all the different ways to be a mother, and mothers judging other mothers, and mothers fighting, you know, for their kids and not to lose their kids or gain their kids back. And all the whole mother thing was really interesting to me. And as was the examination of, you know, cultural of class and race. And the fact that I was extra excited when I found out that Mia was going to be Carrie, mm-hmm. Because by casting it brings a whole new element to the story if you make that character and her daughter Pearl African-American. So yeah, I was definitely on board to pitch, and then I pitched harder for that job than I have ever pitched for anything in my life. I went through, by the time I actually got ready for I did four separate pitches that were each about an hour and a half long, and first to the producing partners of Carrie and Reese, Pilar Savone and Lauren Neustadter, and the showrunner Liz Tiglar. And then I made that round, went to round two, which was Reese and Carrie, went to round three, which is ABC Studios, and round four was Hulu. And I, each time, whoever was in the meeting got a 99-page lookbook from me. I was determined to get that job. And it was so well worth it. I mean, I just can't believe I'm so pinching myself that I got to be a part of putting that story into the world. I learned so much, and I had such an incredible time doing it.
So what was in the lookbook?
Well, let's see. There were conceptual, there were reference points, visual, tonal references for each character. Mm-hmm. There were very personal references from my own life as I was describing how personally connected I felt and why. I mean, in short, I felt like I kind of had Elena's life, but wanted Mia's. Mm-hmm. Ever since I was a little girl, I had this vision of being a single mother with a daughter who, you know, was my mini me, basically. And we would live as artists, you know, in the world, the two of us against the world. I mean, it was kind of crazy how how similar my vision was as a child. My grown-up self was going to be Mia and Pearl. It was really fascinating. My first art form was poetry. I was a very serious poet when I was a kid, like Pearl is. And then I ended up going to photography school at the School of Visual Arts, just like Mia did, for my MFA. My MFA was in photography at the School of Visual Arts in New York City. So there were just all these really strange parallels. And so I kind of illustrated that, you know, in some of these photographs, and I showed the photography from my own art photography days when I was a photographer. Mm-hmm. And that was my art form. I went through references of Shaker Heights. I did research on Shaker Heights, and I gave visual references for that. I talked about the seasons and how each, and I had pulled references from different movies, like Call Me By Your Name for summer and The Ice Storm for winter, you know, and describing how we were going to be going from this warm, luxurious light of summer. And as tensions grew, you know, the palette would get cooler and it would, you know, that kind of thing. I took through that. I talked about the camera language that would be a different camera language to introduce Elena Richardson as opposed to Mia Warren, and, you know, just kind of, yeah, I just went through every single detail I could think of. And then there was a whole section on the 90s. There was a lot of photographs from a photographer named Tina Barney, who did a lot of work in the 90s, 80s through today, but a lot of her seminal work was done in the 90s. And she really has this very kind of candid, not portraits. They're all candid photographs. You know what mm-hmm. I mean? They're not posed.
Right.
And they are of this very white upper middle class world it's this world that really sort of oozes white privilege mm-hmm. and upper class privilege. And but in a very real human way. I don't know how to describe it. But I immediately thought of her, and I bought a book, a big tome of hers. And then I used her photographs as references, as well as I talked about the tonal, how I wanted it to seem really like the characters to all be very authentic and, you know, live. And I wanted it to feel lived in and not just like, you know, showrooms. Like, I wanted the production design to really, really have texture. And anyway, yeah, all of it, every aspect I could think of was in that book.
That sounds like a very type A Reese Witherspoon-y kind of way to prepare for a project.
Yes, there is my,
there's a Tracy Flick in there.
Elena streak. Yeah, for sure. For sure.
So, you know, obviously you directed 4 out of the 8 episodes, roughly, you know, half the series. And then there were other yep. directors on the series as well. Why do you, you know, as executive producer as well, why was it not a decision made to sort of go with one directorial voice through the whole series?
Well, they had just gone through that process. It is a choice that's been made, I mm-hmm. think, for these limited, you know, shorter series. And that concept of having one auteur and really seeing it through, they had just done that with, Andrea Arnold had just done that with the second season of Big Little Lies.
Right.
And, you know, it's mm-hmm. so much
sure.
because, and it makes the whole process, it's also more expensive because the whole process gets more drawn out. Because the thing that's efficient about having more than one director is that when one person is shooting, the other person can be prepping. Mm-hmm. And it means that the whole thing gets condensed, you know, the whole process gets compressed to a certain degree. It doesn't get, it's not a perfect, like, in half kind of thing, but it definitely condenses it. And so by having two DPs and two other directors, my DP could be with me the whole time during all of my prep and all of my shooting. And then each of the two other directors got the other DP, the amazing Jeffrey Waldron. And so it enabled a lot more efficiency in the production. And it also enabled me to survive
sure.
the whole process. And not just like keel over from exhaustion, because it was hard enough, honestly, to direct, especially the two of my episodes were the premiere episode and the finale, mm-hmm. which were both very ambitious. And not that there was, you know, not that four and five were any, were easy, but comparatively, you know, the pressure to get the fire just right, and the pressure to, you know, just introduce all the characters and make sure that we're launching it correctly, you know, all of that was a lot. And then my prep process was extra long because I was setting up, I was there while we were setting up and building all the sets from scratch and finding all the locations that would be used throughout every episode, right? Mm-hmm. So I was sort of establishing the look and the tone and the style with Trevor Forrest, my DP, with Jess Kender, the production designer, and of course, you know, of course the producers and writers. We were all establishing the look and feel of the thing for the, that would be carried through the entire season. So it was enough. And they honestly, when they told me, you know, we understand a lot of times that directors, when they're asked to take this gig on, would rather direct every episode. And honestly, there was kind of a FOMO, you know, there was a period, there was definitely a sense of FOMO, like, oh, but I want to be there when, you know, I want to direct that scene and I want to, oh, why am I missing out on that? But I was also deeply grateful. And when they, that was, you know, their thinking, I said, yeah, you know, that's totally fine with me because it'll also mean, you know, 7 months of my life instead of 12, you know, or whatever. And it's just, and it just feels more manageable, you know, and realistic. And the thing is that as the premiere, when you're doing the pilot episode, you end up and you're there for that extra long prep period before the whole series gets shot. You're establishing so much, mm-hmm. you know, so it really feels as though you are a little bit more of it. It's like a kind of a marriage between what it would be like to make a feature film and what it would be like to direct a TV series as a guest episodic. But, you know, a pilot is like you're bringing your own vision and your own resources, but you're channeling those skills and those visions and those ideas to the purpose of the showrunner, you know, right. to the purpose of whatever the head writer's vision is and trying to get their vision from the script, you know, from paper onto the screen. So that's kind of your role.
I have this vision in my head of you coming into a meeting with the other two directors and just taking that lookbook and just like dropping it on the table and said, this is mine. Take it in.
Well, of course, that was just my pitch, you know, yeah. So it wasn't what any, there was nothing final about it. It was right. just what got me the job, right. you know, and then some of, but I mean, it was nice to hear. I actually did a panel of some kind with Liz Tigelar, who said, oh my gosh, that became such a touchstone for us, Lynn. Like we actually referred to that lookbook a lot. And I didn't, more than I even realized, you know, for me, I thought it was just like, well, that's how I got the gig, you know, and now we can toss it in the garbage. But I did work so hard on it, and it was a real touchstone for me. So I ended up tearing it apart and putting it up on one entire wall in my office. I just like put it all up so that I could remember and be, you know, be reminded of those initial inspirations. But yeah, it was definitely useful to communicate along with all the other stuff that ended up, you know, coming into fruition before the other directors came on board. But I didn't really get that much time with them, honestly, because I was working so hard on my own episodes mm-hmm. when they were in prep. I had a little more time with Michael Weaver, I feel like, because I think there was a little bit more of a, I was editing. We had a little bit of a hiatus between the first episode and the second one. And I was editing the first episode. And then I had a little longer prep period for my episode 4 and 5. And so I think I felt like I got a little bit more time with him to just talk about, you know, just sort of get all of that information across to him. But it's also useful because they have the other episodes to look at. Sure. So they can kind of soak it in that way.
So you mentioned earlier about bringing Kerry Washington into the piece, and in the novel, the race or ethnicity of Mia is never really clear. I don't think it's ever actually referenced. And being Southern born and raised, you know, going through the scene of Reese Witherspoon's character asking Kerry Washington's Mia to be her maid, you know, it's just my skin was just crawling. Like I'm just bringing like these decades of like Southern yeah. issues to this material.
Sure.
you know, I have to assume that that was very deliberate, that that was the kind of thing that was being added to layer on top of the themes of the novel.
Yeah, for sure. I think that I mean, I don't know how much of all the ripple effects and ramifications of that casting decision and that, or that really the invitation to co-produce, you know, mm-hmm. she's the other executive producer. I don't know if that was fully understood until they got into the development of the storyline and realized, oh, this has to be addressed, and it has to be addressed in this way, and it's going to ripple through, you know, in all these other ways. I think there was clearly an understanding that it would, you know, bring the racial issues to the forefront and in a very, and deepen those issues, which were already in the book, but definitely now there's new opportunities and new avenues to explore them. And that's a great example of a moment that is just so much more loaded.
Yes.
Initially it's already kind of insulting, you know, to the Mia in the book, who I think, as I was listening really closely to see, is there any indication of what she is? And I became convinced by the end that she was white in the book.
Yes.
But you're right. It's never referred to, but it just would be too bizarre to not have it be referred to, because there's other issues of race are brought up. And so it just seemed strange that, it, you know what I mean? That she would be anything other than white after you finish reading the book. Mm-hmm. But yeah, to cast Carrie in that role was so great, because what it allowed for, you know, this is that moment, I don't think would have worked or been as believable if the story had been set in 2019 or 2020, because there's so much more, even though it's only been 20 years. It doesn't seem, to me, 1997 doesn't seem that far away, or 1996, whatever it is. But there was so much less consciousness. And there's already, like, there's still an incredible, still a huge gap and a huge amount of ignorance in overall in this country about white privilege.
For sure.
But the systemic racism and the idea of, quote unquote, being woke mm-hmm. yep. to your own privilege. You know, there's this amazing book that Liz Tiglar had everybody in her writer's room read, and then I read it as well, and I was so happy I did, called White Fragility. It's like one of these books that every white person on earth should read. And it only came out in like 2018, 2019. And she posits that there's been no more damage done to African-American people in this country than in modern day times than by white liberals, because they're so defensive right. when told that they might be doing something or behaving or, you know, in any way might be doing something racist. They're so defensive about it because they've been raised and brainwashed to be told, you know, to think that that means they're a monster, you right. know, that racists are monsters. And so they spend all their time defending themselves and saying, well, my mother marched with Martin Luther King. And are you kidding? I'm the last thing from being racist. I don't have a racist bone in my body. Blah, 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 blah. That they miss, you know, the fact that there's this institutional racism that we've been swimming in, and that, you know, just by acknowledging that you've had privilege in your life and a leg up from the beginning doesn't take away from the fact that you may have worked really hard to get where you're at, but you have to acknowledge that you had a leg up, you know, it yep. just is the facts, you know, but all of that was so much less understood back then by white people, you know, and black people knew it. I think a lot of black people knew it, but white people were so unwoke, you know, that moment could actually happen. And even then you can see Elena's character immediately start backpedaling, like realizing from the reaction that Mia just gave her that, oh, did I put my foot in my mouth? But she doesn't even really know. Like, she's like, I mean, a house manager, house you know, manager.
Yeah.
a helper. Like, she's trying desperately to figure out, you know, what to say to get herself out of it. But when she said it, she literally had no sense at all. She was so blissfully ignorant that she was doing anything but trying to be helpful to this person, this deserving person, you know, that's, just like, oh my God. Yeah. It's so, so classic.
Her radar wasn't on to that because her daughter dates a black man.
Exactly. And her mother marched with Martin Luther King, you know, Jr. That's the thing. Yeah, exactly. So she's good. She knows she's good. So anything she does is fine because she's not a racist.
So looking at the finished product, there are other changes from the novel, obviously.
Yeah.
But when you get to the ending, you know, the huge change that fans of the book, you know, obviously will recognize is, you know, the identity of the arsonist, basically.
Right.
Shifting from the single arsonist to the the group. What does that do for the story, in your opinion?
Well, the change, well, first of all, what's very comforting is that Celesting was so open and egoless about these changes that were being asked, you know, for her to be okay with. And she was genuinely fine with them. And I think the reason is that none of the changes were gratuitous or not thoroughly thought out and deliberated over. And the reasons that they have, you know, there were reasons behind every one of them. And none of those changes, I think, betrayed the core truths and themes of the book.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they all were, it was almost like, here's another way that this could have played out. But it's all still true to the characters, true to the story, and true to the themes. And so I think that's why she was like, great, you know, have at it. Like, because you're not trying to change the very nature of the story. You're actually just exploring kind of it's almost like a deepening or in the case of the ending, another way that this could have played out in a way, if that makes sense. And the thing that I think that happens when you let the siblings of Izzy be the ultimate house burners is that it allows for those characters to find redemption or to have a more of a satisfying arc to all of their characters because they wake up. They do wake up to what has been going on, to what their mother has done, and to what they might become, you know, and it's a chance for them in their own, you know, in completely rabid, you know, teenage hormone-fueled lack of impulse control states. It's a very dramatic gesture, you know, and very destructive, but it is them saying no more. This will be no more, you know, with this has to end. And this kind of pattern, you know, and not only are we not going to be you, but we're going to stop you in your tracks too. This is a big old wake up call. And it the redemption for me is that it gives them a chance to actually, what is the word I'm looking for? I just used it yesterday to rally around their sister, right? Mm-hmm. To actually show their solidarity with her. And they'd been shitty to her, you know?
Right.
I mean, Moody was the closest one to her, and he was kind of an ally here and there, as was her father. And then her father ends up, you know, shunning her as well because he's got his own shit going on. And he's like, I can't deal with this anymore. So they have a falling out. So she's really, truly alone. And then in order for it to be believable that the other siblings would follow through on what Izzy starts, we also heightened, you know, Liz also heightened the moment right before. So that scene between Lexi and her mom is also added where, you know, Reese's character Elena says, you know, Lexi says, you wanted me to perfect. I'm not perfect. You know, you always wanted me to perfect. I'm not perfect. And she's, yes, you are. And there's another version where she's like, you had to be, you know, yes, you are. You have to be perfect. I'm sorry. You know? And she like just slams the door in her face. And that's the thing that we had to add. And we had to add that as well as an outright rejection of her daughter, Izzy. Which she then allows her at the very, 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 very end to not only in that scene with the cop, when he says, who did this? And she says, I did it. She's owning up as well to all of the terrible things that have happened, you know, and the part that she's played.
Right.
And then at the very end, when she says the last word of the whole show is she says, Izzy. She finally calls her daughter by the name that she wanted to be called. And she's also found redemption as well, because she's realizes, no, I do love you. And I do want to accept you the way you are and not who I want you to be and not the way I want you to be and so on. So it just allowed for more of, I think for more redemption and more of a satisfying arc for more of the characters. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So when you look at that kind of change, and admittedly, you know, to fans of the novel, to those book clubs of women reading this book, that's going to be a huge change, you know, in the show. And that's a lot for them to swallow, given that they have lived with this book for a while. So how do you, and then on top of that, you know, that emotional finale where you've got so many tears, so many yelling, there's so much tension ongoing. How do you, you know, as a director, balance all of that while at the same time giving clues or hints or making that transition into the three kids becoming the arsonists believable? And how does that all balance in terms of your, how do you use your directorial touches to sort of balance those, that all of that stuff going on in the finale?
Yeah, it was a lot. I mean, the good thing was that it was, everybody was on high alert for believability and authenticity, you know, and from the actors to the writers to, you know, everybody. And it's for me as a filmmaker and as a director, it is always my number one priority. Nothing is more important to me than the performances feeling unwritten, to not feel like performances, to feel like reality. I heard this great interview. Mark Maron did this interview with Barry Sonnenfeld, and he said that he learned the trick of asking his actors to say their lines twice as fast because it meant there wasn't enough time for them to do any acting.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Because he said, the last thing I want to see on screen is acting. Yes. All I want to see is reality. You know, and I just thought that was so great.
You know, that's interesting because I just talked to Derek Cianfrance a couple of days ago for I Know This Much Is True. And of course, that also has, I don't know if you've seen it yet, but it's got a lot of highs and lows in it, a lot of mm-hmm. emotional trauma. And he, you know, Mark Ruffalo stars in it, and he was also going through that acting quote unquote moment. And Derek had him do 50 push-ups every single time right before he did the line. And then he would be out of breath. He would be tired. So, you know, when he's in that heightened emotional state, then he's having trouble reading his lines because he's tired. And that sort of cuts through the sort of actorly stuff, you know, so it works.
Yeah. It really does. You know, I, it's funny, speaking of Mark, you're reminding me of, I did this, my last movie was called Sword of Trust, and there's this very emotional scene where Mark Maron, who's the star of the movie, ends up telling this really heartbreaking story from his past. And the shot that we used, it was a nine hour day in the back of the stand mm-hmm. in a very uncomfortable, unair-conditioned studio. It was just like, it was a really arduous, difficult day. And the shot that we used in the movie is one of the last takes of the day. This, you know, a close up on him. And he was so, I found out later, I knew it at the time too, though. But he was so exhausted, and he was so, you know, himself, the actor, right? So exhausted, also furious. You know, he was, because that's where he goes when he's uncomfortable. Physically exhausted, physically sort of, you know, mentally furious, frustrated, and it just gets channeled into this. I mean, it was just amazing. It was one of the best performances by anybody I've ever seen of anything, you know. And it's really interesting. That push up idea is a good one. I'm gonna file that away. But yeah, no, there's a lot. You know, you try to think of ways to help people feel believable. And you know, I gotta give a lot of credit to Reese, because doing the performance that she was doing on camera is hard enough. But I feel like she was even screaming twice as loud when she was off camera to try to help those actors, you know, get the performance that we needed from them.
Yeah.
So even when the camera wasn't on her, she was really giving it her all in the most generous possible way to help the young actors playing Izzy and Lexi, especially to get the, you know, to give them what they needed to genuinely react, you know. It was a very sweet, and she would be very Elena to them. And then once we would, you know, we're all done and called cut, you know, she would come running up to them and give them these big hugs and say, I didn't mean any of it. You know that, right? You know, she'd be improvising, you know, saying extra mean things, surprising them. One of the problems is, you know, you hear the same lines again and again and again, and to pretend like you don't know what the other person's going to say is that's a big part of the job, right? You know, to keep it fresh and keep it believable when it's a written thing. So she would go off book, you know, she'd start to come up with new insults or new terrible, hateful things to say to poor Megan, who was playing Izzy, you know, to get her to really cry. Yeah. I mean, it's so helpful, you know, because it's really hard as an actor to get to that place and be genuine, you know. It's really rough. So,
well, I imagine, yeah. And then coming from Reese too, that would be difficult, because I don't think this is like the first time I've ever seen her be like outwardly mean.
Seriously. Yeah. And there was discussion about that too, you know. It's like, are Reese's fans, you know, is Reese's audience going to accept her in this role? Yeah, it's very interesting. And for Carrie's scenes, Carrie and Pearl, Lexi Underwood, who plays Pearl, they, you know, sometimes Carrie would clear the set, you know, would ask for like 10 minutes of just getting herself to a place, you know, for some of these quieter, really emotional scenes, you know, where she is making up with her daughter, or all the very men, you know, there's a lot of different emotional scenes, but we were always really sensitive to creating a very emotionally safe environment for those emotional scenes as well, you know, on set. And that's something that's really, really helpful for the actors too.
So, much like the book, the limited series ends on several unresolved notes. You know, does Pearl, you know, when she meets her grandparents, how do they welcome her? How do they welcome Mia, what happens with the surrogate family in New York, and then what happens to Megan's character, whose name I've completely forgotten at this moment. It's just completely escaped me.
Izzy,
thank you. Oh, gosh, yeah, Izzy, yeah. Yes, of course, Izzy. Sorry, just a brain fart. It's end of the day for
okay.
me.
No problem.
You know, do you anticipate, or do you think that there is any kind of appetite to continue this series, continue exploring these characters?
To me, no. It does not make any sense to me. I'm somebody who, I've made 8 films, and none of them are tied up with a perfect, neat little bow.
Right.
I really prefer a narrative, both for television and movies. I like the sense that we're dropping in on this seminal moment in these characters' lives, you know, or maybe just a really interesting weekend or whatever it is, you know, but we're dropping in, like parachuting in, and then we get to hang out with them for a while, and then we just get lifted right out, and they keep going on with their lives, you know, beyond what we get to see. And it also gives the audience a chance to use, you know, to become an active participant,
right.
Use their imagination. What do they think happens next?
Yep.
You know, what do they think happens to all of those people and gives them the opportunity to write their own endings for these people. And I love that. I think there's nothing wrong with that. And that when something is tied up too neatly, a narrative is tied up too neatly, I feel I'm left unsatisfied. I feel like, oh, okay, well, that was a really closed book, I guess, you know. Mm-hmm. So anyway, I don't really feel, I also feel like there's a sort of sense of, there's a buzzing kind of exciting frequency that we're left with at the end, and a resonance, as opposed to it just kind of thunk, you know, it's over, or it's like, oh, we're stretching this out longer than it really should have been stretched out. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
There was not really anything more to do, but people really loved that first one so much, so let's do another one because why? You know, and it turns out there's really no, you know, it's just not, there's not enough there, you know, to really make,
sure,
make something as juicy as the first one, or it'll feel forced possibly, you know. I just, so for me, it feels perfect in its one season form.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you look at something like Big Little Lies and you think, okay, I watched that, you know, and I didn't think that there would be a second season. I didn't think there particularly needed to be one. I was happy with that. But then I felt like Andrea really brought something different in the second season, and they explored,
yeah,
characters in a really interesting way, and managed to continue the story by focusing on the reverberations of the original story. So now I don't know that I want a Big Little Lies season 3, but you know.
Right. I guess yeah, I mean, and that was based on a book too. You're correct. Right. It's true. I wasn't even thinking about that, but I guess I was so focused on the novel and the way, to me it just feels like this perfect yeah, way to end the stories. But mm-hmm, you're right. I mean, there are a lot of loose ends, so you certainly could see about trying to come up with an outline and seeing what, you know, if it bore fruit. I mean, I suppose it could be something to be explored, but I would be satisfied with just the one, and yeah, I'm interested to see what might happen if there was a season 2. I do like these characters.
Yes, they're great characters. I'm not sure you can continue little arsonists all over.
Yeah, exactly.
That's, more yeah, little
it
fires.
Feels like it would, just because that the central sort of core of the whole thing has been literally burned down,
yes,
it really is like, okay, well, it's a diaspora. Like, I don't know how it continues in at all the same vein. You know, it would be a completely different show, basically. You know, it's like, I don't know. I feel like they'd all be scattered to the wind somehow, but who knows? Who knows?
Right. Well, I think that's everything I had for you. I did want to close by saying, I don't know if you had anything to do with it, but thank you for bringing the actor out of Marc Maron. I think he's really tremendous.
Oh, have you seen the movie that we did together?
I haven't seen that one. I've seen a lot of his other...
It's the best acting he's ever done. I'm biased, but it is he's so good in Sword of Trust, and it's a delightful short little romp. It's actually funny. And so if you want to be lifted, if you want your spirits lifted, it's streaming on Showtime now. They just went up like a week or two ago. So they're airing it regularly, but you can also just, if you have Showtime, which I imagine you would with,
yes,
your job,
yes,
you can just stream it there too. But anyway, I highly recommend it. If you're a Marc Maron acting fan,
I will check it out.
Pretty great.
I love his podcasts and listened to them for years. And then, you know, seeing him in Glow and in Girls and, you know, all of those he's just really tremendous. I'm a huge fan of his. So thank you.
Good.
And I will check that movie out.
There's this new movie too. I mean, the movie is okay. He's the best thing in it, my humble opinion, but we're a couple, so you,
yes,
should know that.
Yes,
he's in this movie Stardust. Have you heard of this movie? It was supposed to premiere at Tribeca, and it's,
yes,
about this phase of, you know, Bowie's early life, right,
yes,
before he became Bowie, kind of. Yeah, it's interesting. I think it has its flaws, but it definitely is appealing, and he's great. He's sort of the best thing about it. And then the new Respect movie, he's plays Jerry Wexler, the famous record producer. So anyway, he's having a bit of a exciting time right now as an actor, which I'm thrilled by because I love him. I love seeing him on screen. So
awesome.
Good. So I'm glad to hear that. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much, Lynn. This has been a great conversation. Thank you for diving into Little Fires Everywhere with me. And best of luck to you as we all recoup from all of this mess that's going on.
Yeah, stay safe. Stay sane. Thank you so much for the chat.
All right. Take care.
Okay. Bye.